All right, we welcome all of you to the Second Court of Appeals in the year 2016, which sounds very strange so far at least. We have Judge Gardner to my right, Judge Walker to my left, and we'll be sitting as your panel today. We only have one case on our 10:30 docket, so we will go through that. I believe we have Mr. Lee Davis arguing for appellant. And then we have Mr. Mark Cradiville arguing for appellee. All right, are you ready to proceed, Mr. Davis?
Yes, ma'am, we are. All right. May it please the court, I'm Lee Davis on behalf of Avery Antwine, the defendant below, appellant here in this case. We have advanced on direct appeal an ineffective assistance of counsel argument. Obviously an unusual argument to make simply because it's oftentimes difficult, if not impossible, to advance on direct appeal. You just simply don't have that record that gives you any kind of clarity. And that's what makes this case so very different. We have an incredibly clear record with what happened below, the exchanges between the parties and the court and the parties, and then ultimately the defendant and his lawyer, which give us that information to be able to come in and say with some conviction that his lawyer gave him that advice and that led to his plea, which should be vacated because it was involuntary based on that bad advice. It's something of an unusual case because of the, the fervor with which the issues were argued back and forth. I certainly wish there were a couple of different objections down there in the trial court. Had there been a confrontation clause objection by trial counsel, then maybe that gives us an additional argument to be able to advance here. But we don't have that. But we do have enough in this record for this court to be able to say this was wrong, Mr. Antwine got bad advice, that led to his plea, let's give him some help, because we see from the record that there were clearly things going on that implicated or at least suggested the possibility of self-defense, given the history between the parties and what happened with Mr. Antwine's leaving the apartment, the defendant leaving his apartment apparently with a gun in his hand shortly before this incident. There is apparently Mr. Antwine's girlfriend who would have been able to testify to apparently the robbery or burglary of their apartment sometime shortly before. And there's the history of the drug dealing between them. And so we have that in the record here. And is it really detailed? No, it's not extensively detailed. But we can see that there were multiple things that the defense lawyer wanted to develop with the state's witness and probably should have been able to develop with the state's witness, but for whatever reason, the trial court made the ruling that it did.
And was the alleged robbery the evening before or the night before based on this record?
The way I interpret the record, it was shortly before. Well, and I can't... Okay. The sense you get from reading it, at least that I got, was, 30 minutes or an hour or something earlier. There was, as I interpreted it, Mr. Antwine got back to his apartment and learned from the girlfriend that the victim had been over there and apparently, kicked the door in and come in. I don't think we can say precisely when that was, but like I say, my sense is that it was a little while.
But wasn't the victim hiding in the victim of the alleged first robbery hiding in a closet? I mean, was she an eyewitness as to who had broken in?
That's my understanding, yes, is that she had actually been in the apartment when he came in. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of detail there, but there's certainly enough that we can see that something happened there.
I think what I was going to say was my poor recollection probably is that someone testified it was discovered by Mr. Antoine, his burglary, a few minutes before he went back over to Kenneth Cole's house.
Yes, ma'am, and I believe that's what happened, is the sequence of events that we can see here is that Antoine gets to his apartment, learns from apparently the girlfriend that the victim had been over there, and apparently then Antoine goes in search of that victim.
Which was just a few blocks away?
I believe so.
A few doors away.
I think it was an adjoining apartment complex is how I interpret the record. And so not the building across the parking lot, but, you know, maybe had to cross the street or go down the block.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we have the victim leaving his apartment apparently with a gun in his hand just moments before the shootout occurs. And so, why that was not allowed to be developed in the trial court, we really can't say. Clearly, there seemed to be a misunderstanding apparently by everybody, state's counsel, defense counsel, and the trial court, that Mr. Antoine had to testify and put that state of mind at issue. And that's what is contrary to decades of established case law. And then we come back that next morning when we have Mr. Antoine changing his plea of guilty, changing his plea to guilty. And that's where we get the colloquy between defense counsel at trial and Mr. Antoine about why he is pleading guilty. And so given that clarity, that's why we tried to focus this issue as narrowly as possible, because we have that exchange there where trial counsel is talking to Mr. Antoine about, okay, we were going to present the self-defense evidence, and trial judge has told us that we cannot develop that. It's not going to be admissible. And so we've talked about that, and because of that, now you want to, change your plea to guilty, so that
okay,
you can.
Okay, so I understand your arguments concerning the first prong of Strickland, but under the second prong of Strickland, to get relief, the defendant still has to show that there's a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. So how does that juxtapose in this case? Is it your burden to show that the guilty plea would not have been a guilty verdict? I mean, how does that juxtapose under these particular facts?
Well, presumably Mr. Antoine would have seen the trial through. And the state has asked us to speculate about what might have jumped up and caused him, for unknown imaginary reasons, to wind up pleading guilty for some other reason. But what happens here is that he does not see the trial through. He pleads guilty. He gets 15 years. Now, this is a unique situation in that not only could Mr. Antwine have testified about what happened to raise that guilt-innocence issue, but we've got those other witnesses. So it falls short a couple of ways. The self-defense issue, which is at least potentially viable under the facts that we have seen so far, at least to get that instruction, is totally tossed into the wind. And even if the trial court was not going to allow counsel to develop with the state's witness, the sister of the victim, and conceivably would not have allowed Antoine's girlfriend to testify, we don't know, because that was never developed. We don't have the defense counsel presenting her and getting an adverse ruling, making a bill, or anything like that. But he didn't have to plead guilty to still pursue that self-defense issue. He could have testified himself. And so it falls short two different ways here. It completely abandons self-defense, both by, you know, Mr. Antwon's pleading guilty when he didn't need to and not being able to advance.
That's my question, is what do you think is the, was your burden to show the result of the proceeding would have been different? In other words, do you think you have to show that he wouldn't have been found guilty, that self-defense would have been raised, that he wouldn't have pleaded guilty? I mean, what do you think you have shown to meet the burden under the second prong of Strickland?
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. Yes, well, clearly he would not have pleaded guilty because he pleaded guilty on this bad advice, and he would and should have gotten a self-defense instruction or at least been able to raise that issue before the court if it had been denied. And I believe this court has twice already, well, it's 2016, twice last year, reversed cases where trial judges refused to give self-defense instructions when they were suggested by the evidence. And that's part of the problem here, is it takes so little to get that self-defense instruction. So, you know, we could have seen that, and that would have possibly made a huge difference. But he is deprived of even the opportunity to present that to the jury. If that, does that answer the question?
I think so. Thank you.
Okay. So that's the key thing, though, here, is that we do have, I think, the clarity of the record with what transpired down there in the trial court. And that's something that we don't really see here. The reason we don't see very many of these type claims advanced on direct appeal and such a minuscule percentage of them succeed is because we just don't have what we have in this case. And that is very clearly the basis for rulings, the kind of evidence that would have been adduced, and that leading to what happened here. As I started to talk about a minute ago, the state has suggested that we need to speculate about all these other things. Well, if this was a case where we had to go through a process of elimination and say, okay, well, this might have been trial counsel's strategy, but okay, no, here's a reason it's not. Okay, well, here's another thing that might have been trial counsel's strategy, but okay, in this case, here's a reason it was not. And if you have to go through that, then that's because you've got that lack of clarity and specificity in the record. That's just not the case here. There's such clarity with what happened, why it happened, and the result. Mr. Antwine pleads guilty to a jury that hasn't been voir dired on punishment, gets 15 years. And so that is why we would ask the court to find that he received ineffective assistance, more specifically the bad advice about what was admissible and what could have been admissible and how he could have proceeded that leads to his guilty plea and 15-year sentence. So, if the court has no more questions, I'd yield back whatever time I have remaining. But
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Mr. Cradiville.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. In my former life as a public defender down in Houston, I hated doing ineffective assistance of counsel claims, particularly on direct appeal. They're very hard claims to make. But what you really have to have is clarity in the record. And I have to disagree with the appellant here that this is not an incredibly clear record. And the problem with it is that I'll freely admit in the state's brief here that there are a lot of reasonable speculation arguments that I put out about why trial counsel did the things that she did. And that's the standard that this court has to apply here, is that if there is a reasonable strategy that you can imagine, anything under the sun for why trial counsel did what they did, then they cannot be found ineffective. Then they cannot meet the first prong of Strickland. But I would say that this court can dispose of this case, and specifically the ineffective assistance point of error, without even having to contemplate the first prong of Strickland here. Justice Walker, you brought up the harm argument, and that's where this claim just has no hope of success. And we can sit here and argue about what the record says and what it doesn't say and speculate about certain things, but here's one thing that we don't have to speculate about, and that is that this self-defense claim had no hope of success. Zero. And we know that based on two things. In particular, first, we have the appellant's testimony where he lays out in great detail about how this event occurred, how the shooting occurred. And under any interpretation of what the appellant explains in recounting the events, his own testimony would prevent him from getting a self-defense instruction in this case as a matter of law, because under 9.31, the first part of the self-defense statute, the non-lethal defense self-defense statute, you cannot commit unlawful carrying of a weapon when you go to confront somebody. And that is precisely, by his own admission, what he did. He was on felony probation, was prohibited from carrying a weapon, and went on to somebody else's premises while he was unlicensed carrying a handgun. And so under either one of the manners and means that's in 4602, the unlawful carrying of a weapon, he committed that offense, and he could not have received a self-defense instruction, presuming that his testimony in the punishment phase would have matched what he would have given at guilt-innocence had he testified. But even if he had not testified, just as a practical matter, his self-defense instruction, he would have gotten the instruction. I'll freely concede that. There was sufficient evidence in the guilt-innocence phase as it stood for him to have received a self-defense instruction. But it was a futile effort, because the only evidence outside of his testimony that self-defense, the idea of self-defense would have been raised, was the testimony of Nicole Pink, the complainant's sister, who said that she thought he had a gun, the complainant had a gun when he left the apartment. That's it. And I'll concede, that's enough to get him the self-defense instruction. But if that's all you're going on, then he would have not had any success in this regard in asserting self-defense just on the fact that the other person was armed on their premises, on their own premises. And the standard under Strickland, Justice Walker, about what we have to look at for harm is it has to undermine confidence in the verdict. And bearing in mind that the self-defense route here would have had no hope of success, I don't think that this undermines the confidence in the verdict at all, particularly in light of what we know the appellant said at the punishment phase. And I'll just clarify a couple of points on the record that were brought up. Chief Justice Livingston, I believe you were asking in regards to eyewitnesses to the robbery of the appellant's apartment. And yes, there was some evidence in the appellant's testimony during the punishment phase that his girlfriend was there and was hiding in a closet. And on top of that, that his neighbor across the hall also saw the complainant coming out of the appellant's apartment. Now, bear in mind, however, this is all coming from the appellant. This is all self-serving testimony coming from the appellant. And the record is silent as to where the girlfriend is and where that neighbor is. And that's another problem with pursuing ineffective assistance of counsel claims on direct appeal, is we don't know whether trial counsel was able to locate these people, whether they would have been available to testify, or what the nature of their testimony would have been. And that's why this claim should be pursued on a writ rather than on direct appeal, because these are just questions that need to be answered to fully and fairly litigate any ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And the record is 100% silent on this.
One witness was the girlfriend, you said, that he said, and what was the other one?
The appellant claimed that his neighbor across the hall in another apartment saw the complainant walking out. But bear in mind, again, this is just the appellant's own testimony that he was giving at punishment phase, so it was, of course, self-serving in this respect, and we don't have any evidence beyond his claims to back that up in the record. And then in regards to the distance of the apartment complexes, there is some sort of explanation on how long the appellant took to drive from one spot to another, but we do know that they are different complexes, and that he had to drive between them. And I believe he says something about how many minutes it took, but I don't recall off the top of my head how long that was. But they're for sure different complexes. This is not him going from one apartment in the same complex to a different apartment. So, one other point I would bring up here is that the interpretation of what is occurring, going to the first prong of Strickland here about the deficient performance. Again, I'm very confident that this court can dispose of this claim just based on harm. But in regards to the first prong on Strickland, the testimony from the admonishments prior to the appellant entering a plea. I don't think that this court should look at the statements made by counsel in the form of questions as anything that can support an ineffective assistance claim, because these questions are not being made in the context of exploring her trial strategy and whatnot. This is her admonishing her client to ensure that his plea is being made voluntarily, not to lay out her trial strategy. So even though this can be viewed as something akin to testimony from defense counsel in exploring an ineffective claim, that's not what this is. This is her questioning the defendant to ensure that what he is doing is being done freely and voluntarily. And one interpretation of what's occurring here in the admonishments prior to the entry of the appellant's plea that I think is pretty compelling is the fact that what she's saying is factually accurate, that the evidence that they attempted to get in during the first day of guilt-innocence was not held to be admissible. And what the trial court said was that not that it was wholly inadmissible, but that it was premature in its relevance because it was dependent on the appellant's testimony. And that's correct. As I point out in my brief, there's two routes of admissibility for the type of evidence that defense counsel was trying to get in here. In regards to self-defense, you can either show evidence of the complainant being the first aggressor, which the appellant here would not have to be subjectively aware of, so you could have a third party testify about that. Or alternatively, you can show evidence of reasonable apprehension of danger based on the complainant's known violent tendencies. And that the appellant would have had to have been subjectively aware of. And the only way to get that evidence in would be through the appellant's own testimony. And that's why it was held to be premature in its relevance. But there's a problem with the type of evidence that the appellant was pursuing here. And there's two things. It's one, carrying a gun, habitually carrying a gun, and the second, buying marijuana. Neither one of those is evidence of a violent tendency. Carrying a gun by itself, without more, not enough to show a violent tendency. Buying marijuana, while it is a bad act, an extraneous crime, still not violent in of itself. So it's inadmissible under 404B at that point, and it may be interesting background information, but the 404B bar still comes into play unless there is another route of admissibility. And through the self-defense routes, which I outlined a moment ago, they're still not admissible. And that's explains the trial court's ruling here. It was correct, and so it makes sense in context. And if the court has no further questions, I'll be happy to yield back the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
We'd ask the court to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Give us just a moment here. If the clerk can, are we having difficulty with the lighting system? Is it, it didn't stay green or turn yellow.
Well, that's true. I don't think I saw lights either.
Yeah, it, okay. Okay. All right, let's start over again for the rebuttal, if you will, please. Thank you. I'll watch it time-wise, too, just in case.
I can't imagine a lawyer would take more time than the court had allowed, of course, but... the couple of points I would make in response here are that we've got a situation where the defendant didn't need to testify here. And yes, I mean, to the extent that we're talking about the known violent tendencies that Mr. Cradiville mentioned, then yes, that could require the defendant's testimony. But that's not the only thing we had going on here. We had people other than the defendant who could testify to the events immediately preceding this shooting, and it appears that that testimony would go to the victim here being the aggressor. So we don't need Mr. Antwon's testimony, and that's why this is a situation where we really actually have some argument here, because there's so much more to this. This is not just simply the he said, she said, one person and another in a vacuum. We have multiple witnesses able to testify to multiple things, and it may just be that the trial court and state's trial counsel were assuming that it was about the tendencies of the person based on the history.
I have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
I've read in your brief where you set forth the dialogue that you're referencing right prior to Mr. Antwon pleading guilty, and then you say in your brief, Antwon then pleaded guilty to the jury. And I have not read the record at that spot. Does his guilty plea contain any admonishments by the trial court or any of the typical guilty plea dialogue between the trial court and Mr. Antwon?
There's a little bit. There are no written plea admonishments of any kind. That was not done. And the trial judge went through a very brief okay, so, you know, here's what you're pleading guilty to. You've got to voluntarily do this. This is a range of punishment. Are you happy with your trial counsel? So you're pleading guilty. I mean, it was literally about, and I think I can go right to it, because I think it's about page 5 of volume 5. It's very, very abbreviated. It starts on page...
I believe your brief says 14.
I believe that's where the back and forth with the with trial counsel is. The trial court on page 6 has a two-paragraph situation here. It starts out, all right, now you understand, Mr. Antwon, that by entering a plea of guilty or changing your plea of guilty, before the jury, you're waiving your right to have a full appeal with regard to guilt-innocence. And then there's a somewhat longer paragraph that talks about waiving your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. You've discussed your case with your lawyer, and you're saying you're satisfied with the representation. You're waiving any issue of appeal with regard to those matters. Is that correct? And then he talks a little bit, the trial court talks a little bit to him about you're pleading guilty to the jury, and they're going to assess the punishment. And that's, and then there's a couple of more paragraphs.
About you're pleading guilty because you are guilty, et cetera.
Well, actually, I'm not even sure that that's in there. There's admonishment of the range of punishment, an admonishment that he's not eligible for probation because of a prior felony conviction. There's talk about we don't know what the jury's going to do because there's no voir dire on that. And then, you know, understanding that, and you've talked to your lawyer, so that's what you want to do.
I guess my question is, how can a case ever meet the second prong of the Strickland standard when there's a knowing and voluntary guilty plea?
Is it really knowing and voluntary, though, when his trial counsel misleads him about what is admissible and is wrong about what is admissible? And now we're trying to keep this narrowly focused because the record doesn't give us enough to be able to say, okay, what the victim's sister would have said or what The girlfriend would have said, and why were they not called? I mean, on a writ, obviously, I think one of the issues would be, why, trial counsel, did you not have these people here, or at least the girlfriend, and why did you not try and put her on? Why did you not make that bill? What was that testimony? So we're threading the needle, really. So, and I think I have even exhausted the red lights. So.
The victim didn't testify either.
I'm sorry, the victim's girlfriend testified. But no, the victim did not testify at all. And the record is silent on why that was the case.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Davis and Mr. Cradiville. We appreciate all your arguments today, as well as your briefing for the submission this morning. Your case is now submitted, and we will adjourn court.